So I'll start off by chanting the four vowels. Anyone that knows it is welcome to join in. Shigu segan mo on shujo.
Zen in daily life. I can't remember exactly what the title was, but it's something like those ones. It's a question that's been on my mind for, 25 years. Because Zen is traditionally a monastic discipline in that people come together and live in monasteries, nunneries, practice together. And that's not quite what we do. The question is, how can we make this tradition, how can we find within this tradition a way of practicing which works for the lives that we lead, for the lives that each of us leads? And the wonderful thing about a monastic tradition is the sense of being together, the sense of working together, as opposed to some other Asian traditions, spiritual traditions, like the yogic tradition, where it's more about the individual practicing. And in Buddhism, the sangha, the community, is very important. And what is great about, as I say, the monastic tradition is that there is a sense of being together constantly. It's great, but also, of course, being together, as any of you who have lived in relationships know, being together is not always easy, and it's the same in the monastery. So that's kind of the question that I live with and try to make sense of. What I want to do is speak a bit about the teachings of Zen, because Zen is taught primarily through what we do. It's practice. So we talk quite a lot. You know, Zen teachers do talk quite a lot. You write quite a lot, etc. But Zen is primarily transmitted through practice. And that practice has a certain meaning. The practice has a is intended to connect one with certain ways of being, ways of doing, ways of experiencing life, and the question is how we can allow that to expand beyond the time that we're together. Exactly. So that's kind of what I wanted to talk about. And so I wanted to look at different parts of Zen practice, things we're doing today, and say a little bit about each of them, and how we can take them out beyond the dojo. And the first, of course, the most important part of Zen practice is the practice of Zazen, which we've just been doing. It's the most important part of Buddhist practice. In many ways, to be a Buddhist is to meditate, to sit with awareness. And it's difficult to imagine. There are a few Buddhist schools where they don't, but it's difficult to imagine being a Buddhist without sitting, because that is what the Buddha did. And the core of the Buddha's teaching was sit with reality as it is and experience it. And as I've already said, during our sits, the art of Zazen, both the simple art but also the challenging, is to simply sit with the present moment as it is, being open, having an open, alert awareness of the present moment as it is. And another key part of the practice which monastic life gives you easily is creating a rhythm. So being aware, being connecting with the awareness of Zazen requires a rhythm of practice. It requires returning again and again and again and again. And Nancy, who taught, was one of the, she was one of the founders of our Sangha in the UK. She used to like to quote the phrase that it's like water dripping on a stone over time. And it's that steady drip that naturally and unconsciously, automatically wears a groove in your karma. And so that steadiness of practice is profoundly important. And another thing that Nancy says in her book, Diary of a Zen Nun, she says that when you're on a retreat or living in a monastery, then it's easy on discipline, hard on the ego. Whereas when you live in everyday life, it's easy on the ego, but hard on discipline. Meaning the thing that you to find the discipline that's necessary to create this rhythm is very important. And it'll be different for, the important thing is to have that rhythm. It'll be different from each of us, but having, creating a rhythm of practice is deeply important. And so that rhythm can be partly when one practices at the dojo with others, and that's a very important part of the practice, as I said earlier. Very important having that steady time with others, but also if you're not able to come to the dojo as often as you'd like, also having some form of practice on your own is a good way of supporting the practice one has in the dojo. So having a steadiness of practice through a combination of practicing with others, and when that's not possible, practicing alone, is a good way of creating that rhythm. And again, as Nancy said, it's easy on the ego but hard on discipline, so it requires a certain amount of discipline trying to create that rhythm. Whereas in a temple, you just simply go to the dojo when the wood sounds. You don't need to worry about shall I or shan't I? And so you just go on. So creating that discipline is difficult. But the thing is, that steady awareness, the other thing to say about it is that formal practice is deeply important, but that steady awareness permeates life in a temple, the practice on a Zen day. That steady awareness permeates the different parts of the day, whether we're eating, whether we're chanting, whether we're working together, etc. And can you bring that into, even when you're not with the Sangha, with the group of other people of practice, can you bring that steady awareness to what you do? Can you bring that steady, open awareness to the different tasks that you do in your life, whether it is at home, or whether it is at work, whether it is a physical task like washing up or working in the allotment, or whether it is a more intellectual task or emotional task like dealing with a difficult colleague at work who you have a hard time with. All of these things require being open and aware. And Zazen is the practice which develops and cultivates a habit of being open and aware. And we can put it into practice again and again and again at moments in our lives. So that's the first thing I want to say about, and as I say, that is the most important part of Zen practice, is this cultivation of awareness through formal practice, but also finding ways of finding it elsewhere. If you're in a monastery, then whatever you do, when you're cleaning your teeth, you chant a little chant of awareness. When you go to the loo, you chant a little chant of awareness, if you're doing the full traditional practice, what's called gathas. And so it's good to remind yourself throughout the day, when you're doing these actions, to be aware. I like to try to remind myself before I do my emails. That's one thing that... So trying to bring this sense of awareness and commitment back again and again and again. So creating a rhythm of practice, finding awareness in life. The next thing I wanted to say is... another part of our practice is Gesho. And we bow Gesho, we bow to the Buddha, we bow to our Zafu, to ourselves and to all the other people who are present. And Gesho is primarily about respect. Respect for oneself and respect for others. And that respect comes from a sense that at a deep fundamental level, we are not different. So when you're bowing to someone else, at a deep fundamental level, we are not different. There might be differences in in phenomena, but at a deep fundamental level, we are profoundly, there is something fundamental, some fundamental humanity, some fundamental being which we share, and that goes beyond all the differences, all the likes and dislikes which we naturally express in everyday life. And again, finding that sense of respect for those around you, those that you work with, those that you live with, those that you interact with in the shops, on the street, etc. Having a sense that fundamentally that other person is, at a deep fundamental level, okay. Whether what they manifest on top might be problematic for you, what they manifest on top might actually make you like them. But whatever it is, at a deep fundamental level, they simply are, and there's a deep fundamental humanity that you share. And so having that sense of respect for the other is a part of our practice. Dogen talks about that in his instructions for the cook. He talks about how we must have a caring attitude of respect for others. And so, of course, there will be moments of challenge, but nonetheless, seeing that each of us shares this fundamental, what is called in the traditional text, the Buddha nature, seeing that we each share that fundamental level means that we can put aside, though, when someone does something that hurts us or whatever, we can put it aside to an extent. Just to be clear, it does not mean that we don't respond if there is injustice in the world and we can do something about it. It is okay to respond. If someone's being unfair to you, it's okay to respond. You don't have to become a martyr. But the response should come from a place of not necessarily wanting to prove that you are right or better than the other person. The response should come from a place of simply resolving the situation. Resolving the situation as it is. So rather than a sense of wanting to prove that one is better than the other. So even in the sense of conflict, there can be respect. So the next thing I wanted to speak about was gratitude. So if Gassho represents respect, then an important part of Zen practice is gratitude. And that appears in a few different places in our practice. One is when we do the meal ceremony. When we do the meal ceremony, part of the meal ceremony is gratitude for what we receive, gratitude for the food that we're given, gratefulness to all of existence which has passed the food to us, the people who prepared it, the plants and animals that have contributed to its creation, the ecosystem which has brought it into being. So there is a sense of gratitude to all those who have gone before us, who bring that food to us. And there's also gratitude in what we chanted this morning, the Patriarch's Echo. The Patriarch's Echo is a list of the kind of teachers who have passed the transmission, passed the teaching from one to the other, from the Buddha down through the teachers of India, to the teachers of China, and then some teachers in Japan, and then finally to us. And so it's the sense of transmission, gratitude for the teachings that have been passed down to us. And when I was at a retreat in France at La Jonvenier last year, there was a teacher there who spoke about this a little bit. And he said that there's these names that we recite, and we must think about them more as representatives, because they're, if you like, the big names. And the big names aren't necessarily what's most important. What's most important is the nameless ones who keep the practice going humbly and quietly without necessarily becoming kind of big names recognised by history. So we must also have gratitude for the many nameless people who have passed the teachings from one to another, for the many nameless people who have resulted in us receiving the teachings and resulted in us being given the opportunity to practice. So not only the tradition is passing the teaching which passed to us, but those around us, whether it's family members who give us space, allow us the time out. Gratitude for all of it, which allows us in the end to practice. And so gratitude is an important part of our practice, recognising that in fact we are fortunate. So in a Buddhist sense, traditionally, people would give thanks for the fact that they have been born into a human life where they can practice. That's the traditional kind of the way it's expressed. The way we can think about it in modern times is that we've been born into a situation where we can practice. We are fortunate that we're in the situation we have. Anyone who's born in the UK is, to an extent, has good fortune, no matter what difficulties you face in your life. If you look at the kind of overall global things, there's far worse places to have ended up. And so we have gratitude for what life has given us and what opportunities that has opened for us. And in particular, the opportunity it gives us to practice, to confront our suffering, to work with others to confront the suffering, to have a good community around us. And so that's something to be grateful for. So the next thing is giving. And each time we practice Zazen and practice the ceremony afterwards, we are giving to the world. The chanting is an act of giving. The chanting, traditionally, the chanting is viewed as a gift to a gift of, if you like, merit, good karma, if you like to think about it like that, a gift of good karma to those around. And so one of the things we chant is we say we want to share whatever good comes with this with all beings. We want to share whatever good comes with all beings. Some ceremonies give more specifically. Sometimes you can say, I want to share this with someone who's suffering particularly, a particular person who's suffering, or with someone who's died recently. There's various ways that you can give through the ceremony. So the ceremony is an act of giving. But again, the teacher who spoke last year that I was telling you about earlier on, he was quoting Dogen, and Dogen said that we must think about the many ways in which we can give. So many of us are in good fortune. We might have time, we might have money, we might have experience, we might have abilities, we might have knowledge, whatever it is, then it's good to share that. It's good to give it to others, give it to those who can benefit from it, not to hold it back. So Nancy, as I said earlier on, one of our founders, she used to have the phrase, don't be stingy. That was one of her catchphrases, if you like, was do not be stingy. And so don't be stingy with what you have. Find ways of sharing it with others. That doesn't mean being a complete martyr, as I said before, but find ways to share it with others. Find ways of doing good in the world in smaller and larger ways. But one of the key things about the Zen practice is the notion of no merit or no goal. When you give, just give wholeheartedly. Don't expect something, get something back from it. Don't be giving in the expectation of receiving something, whether it's a pat on the back from someone or some other gift in the future. When you give, it should simply be wholehearted giving because that is the appropriate thing to do in the moment. And also, give appropriately. Give skillfully. Don't just give. Don't either give because you think that you know what's best for that other person and you force it on them. And in fact, it's not appropriate for them to receive it, or it's not appropriate for them to receive it from you. Whether it's advice is something that my wife Ilse, she likes to say, the gift of unasked for advice is one of the most overrated gifts there is. So give skillfully, give in a way that is appropriate, give with the awareness that comes from Zazen. And don't expect in return, just give because that is an expression of one's Buddha nature, just simply express it in the world. So that's giving, which as I say is represented in our practice through chanting. So don't force it on others and don't give with an agenda. So next thing I want to say about, not everyone wears a wakasa or a kesa, but the kesa, it has different symbolism. And the symbolism which I wanted to pick up on today is that the kesa is the symbol of non-discrimination. It's the symbol of making do with what there is and making the best use of it. And the reason is The reason why it represents this is because historically, the kesa was originally sown by Buddha to make the robes that him and the monks and nuns wore out of old rags, which were the rags which were used to wrap the dead, or by women who were menstruating, things that were considered unclean in the society that he lived in. And they washed them and sewed them together to make the robes that the monks and nuns wore. And so the kesa represents non-discrimination. It represents the fact that whatever life gives you, then one can do one's best with it. If life gives you a burnt hole in your kesa, you can still find beauty in that. So whatever life gives you, then one can engage with it and find something wonderful in it. Again, Dogen speaks about this when he talks about the instructions for the cook. He says that whether the cook has bitter greens or the finest cream to work with, the cook should still have the same attitude of bringing out the best they can with what they have, bringing out the best they can and passing that on to others. So whatever you have, whatever cards in life, cards you are dealt with by life, then you can still play with it wholeheartedly, still do the best you can wholeheartedly. So it's acceptance of the way things are, acceptance of how things are, and getting on and acting. So again, this is something that Dogen talks about. From a relative point of view, there is difficulty, there is non-difficulty. There is, some things are harder, some things are easier. Some things are, sometimes you are more fortunate, sometimes you are less fortunate. Some things, then from an absolute point of view, all that falls away, and things just simply are as they are. But nonetheless, relative and absolute are both reality, and Dogen says, faced with both of those perspectives, you must act. You must simply act with what you have and do one's best in the situation. So that's the kesa. Then the last thing I want to speak about is sampai. So sampai, which we all did together this morning. Yeah, that is sampai, the act of bowing. And sampai represents the letting go of the ego, the abandoning of the ego. And I don't know if this is actually why, but that's why I actually believe it's good that those people who lead zazen actually have to do more of it than the rest of people. You know, the people on the edge, they do it 3 times, the people in the middle have to do it 6 or 9 times, they do it 3 times at the beginning. So it's a constant reminder. And I was speaking with Reho Jesse Hach, who some of you would have met, because he did a ceremony weekend here about a year ago, was it? Yeah, something like that. And we were talking about the different strands in Zen in Japan. And he said that Kozosawaki, who is connected very much with us, he emphasised the kesa Zazen, practices of Zazen and the kesa. In other words, non-discrimination, making the best of the situation. Whereas there was a kind of very well-recognised master in Japan who was partly responsible for the lineage that Shunryu Suzuki in America belonged to, and he emphasised Zazen again, and the other really important part of practice for him was Sampai, doing the letting go of the ego, and doing Sampai regularly. And when Suzuki was in America, some of the Americans didn't like doing Sampai. They said, well, you know, we're American. I'm not sure it's culturally appropriate for us to do 3 of these vows, because, you know, that's not really our thing. And he said, well, in that case, you should do 9 instead. So he was trying to... And when I was in Korea quite recently. You've been to Korea, haven't you? You lived for a while in Korea. Yeah. I was at an academic conference, and opposite the academic conference there was a Korean temple, and so I visited the temple, and they made me very welcome, and their practice was to do 108 bows, so I did 108 bows with them, which was a good experience. But so the bow, the representation of the bow, is to let go of the ego, and in particular, let go of the desire, let go of our desires and our ambitions, let go of the fact that we want certain things in life, that we're going certain things, going for certain things in life, in our everyday life. I think this is particularly important for our everyday life, whether it's in our family or our career or whatever. There's certain things that maybe we want to, the direction that we want to go in, that we want to head in, and it's we must observe these. So it's harder outside the temple because, as Nancy said, it's easier on the ego but harder on the discipline. There's these things that the kind of daily, the everyday life, there's goals that society sets for you, if you see what I mean, that if you can fall into, and your ego can get caught up in those, that I want to be a successful this, or I want to be a good that. Your ego can get caught up in those, or I want to have, I think, you know, the standard one is I want to have lots of money and a nice car. But I think that if people come here, they already step beyond that. But the question is, how does that manifest in other ways in your life? If you see what I mean, that same drive to have stuff, or even to have an easy life, to have a nice, comfortable life, you know, that same drive can manifest in ourselves, that we kind of want to go in a certain way. So our ego says that we want to make our shape our life in that direction, and we should observe that. We should observe that carefully, and let go of it. So just like thoughts that arise in Zazen, we should observe it and let go of it, not take it so seriously. It doesn't mean necessarily that we make decisions that don't take us in that direction, but we should just take care of it, observe it, not see it as our reason for living. Find something else, find something beyond that for it. So our reason for living is not succeed on going in this particular direction. So we observe our desires and ambitions and let go of them. Observe what we so letting go of the ego, abandon the ego. Don't take them so seriously. And the UK Sangha was formed by two people. One was Nancy, who I've already spoken briefly about. The other was Jean. So if Nancy, one of Nancy's catchphrases was "Don't be stingy," one of Jean's catchphrases was "Beware of spiritual ambition." He used to talk quite a lot about what he would call spiritual ambition. And by that he meant playing the same games that we play in daily life, in everyday life, and transferring them into a Zen environment, effectively, or whatever environment. So playing those same games in a Zen, whether it's we want to become enlightened, that's something that Dogen is very insistent about, that we should let go of the desire to be enlightened. We should let go of the desire to be important in a Zen community or whatever. So just as we can play the same games of trying to get and have stuff in everyday life, we can transfer it into the Zen life. And so again, we should observe, if we see this kind of spiritual ambition in us, we should observe it in us and let go of it and see what manifests. If you observe and let go, then as long as you observe and let go through Zazen, see what manifests. Maybe, just like the kata, what is not so good can be transformed into something good, naturally and unconsciously, through practice, through awareness over time. So those are the kind of 6 points, just to summarise. I spoke about awareness, which is represented by Zazen, respect, which is represented by Gassho, gratitude, which is represented by the meal ceremony and the chanting of the patriarchs, giving, which is represented by chanting, it's also represented by offering incense, non-discrimination, which is represented by the kesa, and letting go of the ego, which is represented by Sampai in our practice. So those are the 6 things. I see they're not the 6 things, they are 6 things. I wouldn't say they're the, you know, it could be a different 6 another day. And if we want to bring those attitudes into our daily life, as I said at the beginning, it's important to find ways of integrating them into the way we live. And the most important thing about to do that is to create a rhythm of practice, coming to the dojo on a regular basis, whether it's once a week or whatever's possible, whatever works in your life, creating a rhythm of practice, and then linking with that practice, so connecting with others through regularly sitting with others, maybe sitting on your own if you can't come to the dojo as often as you would like to, But also finding ways to remind yourself of these things as you go about your daily life. Finding things, so whether you might have a little Buddha statue around the place to remind, to visualise yourself, or get into habits like trying to be present when you clean your teeth or whatever, which is, as I say, it's nowadays it's spoken about as a modern mindfulness practice, but you can find being present while you clean your teeth in 6th century Chinese temple texts, so it's not that new. So finding ways to integrate into your life in a way of, so which can give you some sense of the rhythm that a monastic life can have. Of course, it's not going to be the same as in a monastery. The monastery has advantages over daily life, but it also has risks and disadvantages. One of the risks is that of spiritual ambition. So spiritual ambition tends to manifest itself more in monasteries than it does manifest itself outside of monasteries, because we get pulled by other ambitions. See what I mean? Someone's using a monastery, if they're feeling ambitious, their ambition can only go in one direction. If you're out in everyday life, your ambition can go all over the place. You see what I mean? So there's the same dangers, but they manifest in different ways. Yeah. So that's what I wanted to say.
So we'll finish again. We'll chant the 4 vows for anyone that knows it. Shigu Segan Mo.